You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Paul.
Hello, Bob.
How you doing?
Well, it's been quite a week in my world.
You should mention that because that's what we're going to talk about. What a wild week it's been in your world. Let me tell people who you are. So you are Paul Triolo. You are, for one thing, author of the Substack analytical product known as AI Stack Decrypted, an increasingly influential thing that you apparently choose not to call a newsletter. So I certainly won't use that word. It's an analytical product.
I'm trying not to be tactical. I'm trying to be strategic, right? But lately, I have to become more tactical.
Okay.
As you'll see.
This is among the things you can explain to us. And you're an expert on so many things that I'm not, and your analytical product is one of them. So you're also a consultant at Albright Stonebridge, and above all, you are an expert on a lot of things in the tech world, certainly including the Chinese tech world. And we are now at a moment, tell me if I'm over-dramatizing this, where, thanks to some recent tit-for-tat type acceleration on the trade front between the U.S. and China, things could get out of hand. You're nodding your head. You're affirming this. And I want to help people understand where we are, what the smart thing for the U.S. to do next would be, sure, and what we can expect, but also how it happened. And since most of the audience for this podcast is not a specialist audience with respect to this, I'd like to start with something that probably did hit their radar screen recently, and I want you to tell us what it was a response to. So people may remember Trump saying a few days ago, okay, we're going to have 100% tariffs on China or something like that. Yes. The stock market freaks out. Newspapers take it seriously and, put it on, the top of the news. What, first of all, was he reacting to that China had just done? I mean, we'll go backward, because each reaction is a reaction to something else. Like, but let's start right there.
At the universe and seeing the starlight and realizing that that's
right. So we've got the big bang. Yeah. And now the question is, will this be the end of it all? But right now we're at that moment that what is he reacting to in that moment, Trump?
What he was reacting to was the release by the Chinese Ministry of Commerce of a set of fairly sweeping new rules governing the export of rare earth metals, and products using those rare earth metals globally, which were an addition to existing rules that were released in April that required licensing of exports of those materials. And so, and these are things like magnets. So everybody seems to know magnets because magnets is a little bit easier to talk about, for example, than gadolinium or yttrium or.
Let's stick with magnets. Yeah.
So magnets are used in, the most important thing to know is magnets are used in automobiles. And they're used particularly in EVs. And they help to keep the motor efficient and the battery life long. And they're used in missile systems. All the U.S. missile systems, anti-missile systems, missile systems, all use magnets as part of their guidance systems. And, because it happens that rare earths are very nice to include in those magnets because they enable those magnets to keep operating at, for example, at high temperatures. So magnets turn out to be important for both the civilian industrial sector and green tech in particular, batteries, wind turbines, anything that has a motor probably has a rare earth magnet in it. And then on the defense side, they turn out to be important for specific applications of missiles. And then other rare earths turn out to be really important, particularly for things like sensor systems and detecting various things. And so even though you don't know it, your phone likely contains, some number of these rare elements, depending on the application. And also the semiconductors that we've talked about before on the show, Bob, A lot of the semiconductors are made with tools that contain rare earths that are really important. Or in some cases, the semiconductors themselves, parts of the circuitry actually contain rare earths. The average GPU that NVIDIA makes, for example, which I think we've talked about before, I was just having a long chat with ChatGPT about a long deep dive about how many rare earths are used, for example, in an advanced GPU, you know, for the whole production chain. And it turns out it's anywhere from 6 to 8 rare earths are used at some point in the process, either to produce the chip or to incorporate it inside of it. So these are, you know, these are critical materials, and they sort of snuck up on us here. And, you know, nobody, until recently, fairly recently, nobody realized that China and Chinese companies tend to dominate most of the, if you will, the mining to magnet supply chain, which has many, many pieces to it. Here we are. And that's what the president was reacting, because the Chinese controls seemed to be targeted at the global, at not just US, but at the global supply chains for these materials. And they cut across so many industries, right? From autos to consumer electronics to semiconductors and other things. So that's what he was reacting to. He was reacting to the idea that some put out, which I think is mistaken, and we'll get to, that this was like a Chinese effort to, you know, to coerce the world through its rare earth dominance. And again, I don't think that's what this was, but that was what he was reacting to. And somebody probably told him that this was a big escalation on the part of China and the Ministry of Commerce.
Okay, so it was both a restriction both on the some of the minerals themselves, and I gather it's not like China's the only place you can get those, but it has a lot of them, and it has developed the whole mining and processing industry. So it would take us a while to build an infrastructure. It would involve relations with other nations, and we're doing some of that. But anyway, for now, this is a real point of leverage for them. Now, it sounds like whatever they did wasn't all that narrowly targeted at the United States. You're making it sound pretty global.
Yes.
Is that right?
Well, yeah, and that's because these things, these materials, you know, it's not a simple thing like selling a, you know, an orange that's grown in Florida to another state, right? These are things that are produced in China, then they're incorporated into an assembly or some product, then they're shipped somewhere else, and then they're shipped somewhere else, right? The final product. So by their very nature, these things tend to have more global supply chains. So if a country like China is trying to control these materials, they're probably going to want to know, they're interested in controlling the end use, right? I mean, that's the goal. If you remember, and I'm not sure if we talked about this before, but the original impetus for China controlling this, the argument was some of these materials are being incorporated into military systems at the end of the day. And that's what they're saying. Look, we assert the right to veto, have some power over the use of Chinese origin materials in military systems. This is essentially, of course, what the U.S. has been asserting in the case of semiconductors and other technologies, that for the end uses that we don't like, in this case that China doesn't like, we want to have control over those supply chains. Now, it just happens that rare earths are a little bit farther back in the supply chain than semiconductors. Right. So it's a much more complicated global footprint.
Nonetheless, it is the case. And I know, first of all, that our chip export controls, I think, are not the immediate thing that this was a reaction to. We'll get to the most immediate thing that China considered.
They were the immediate.
Oh, were they? Oh, what? Well, what about this? Well, I'm thinking of the 50% rule, which we can also talk about.
That's about semiconductors.
That is ultimately about semiconductors. Let's just say broadly, of course, the U.S. has been restricting high-end chips exports to China. It has found a way to target them to target China. And we're not restricting them from the whole. Well, we're restricting them to varying degrees, and there are arguments about who we should restrict them and respect to, and so on. But anyway, one interesting thing to me is, in a way, you know, China is saying, you know, you're right that because NVIDIA is an American company, and some of these other companies are. And because you have leverage over the factory in Taiwan, that is the only factory that can make the most advanced chips right now. You can keep us from getting these chips. And in fact, even for some Huawei chips that are, you know, Chinese company, but because they're made at TSMC, the company in Taiwan, we can restrict those too. But in a way, is this China saying, we have a little reminder. Those chips draw on these minerals that, at least for the time being, we have a lot of control over. In fact, I thought I heard that some of the Chinese restrictions specify certain kinds of a kind of semiconductor threshold above which these are not to be used or something, which would sound like a kind of a very direct reference to what we're doing to them. But yes. I don't know that much about it.
Well, look, okay. Let's just try to explain sort of what you went over the U.S. controls. So what the U.S. controls did, the most important part of the U.S. controls. So one of them, as you noted, was controlling the actual finished GPUs that are made and happen to be made in Taiwan, but they're finished product and they have a certain performance threshold. And the U.S. said, okay, above a certain performance threshold, NVIDIA or AMD or Intel can't ship these to China. But the other part of that, the flip side of that, was the assertion over the last 5 years, really, starting with Huawei, was that anywhere U.S. technology was used in the world. Okay, and again, so the argument of some is the Chinese are global and the U.S. is narrow. No, the U.S. controls from the very beginning on Huawei, for example, asserted the right of the U.S. to control the use of U.S. technology anywhere in the world. So if a company was manufacturing semiconductors on behalf of Huawei in Taiwan or South Korea or Japan, that the U.S. was asserting the right to have a veto over that. So now China similarly is saying, okay, well, if the U.S. is going to do that, then we're going to assert that anywhere in the world that uses Chinese rare earths as part of a product that's incorporated into a product, we're going to assert that we have the right to force those companies that are incorporating that to get a license before they ship. Because we're also, as the U.S. has asserted, we're worried about that product ending up in a military application that could damage, you know, could be used against us. So the Chinese are very much mirroring our controls, but it's a different thing, right? Because we're saying, in our case, it's manufacturing technology. So for example, TSMC uses lots of U.S. tools to manufacture semiconductors. And the Chinese are saying, okay, well, if you're using a tool that uses Chinese rare earths as part of that tool, then we should have a say over where that tool gets shipped. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that U.S. officials have been reacting to, because that is a pretty big deal, because those materials, as I noted earlier, are used in a lot of things, right? They're used in magnets that go into cars. They're used in magnets that go into a lot of things. So the U.S. controls were trying to focus on advanced manufacturing equipment and that sort of segment. And the Chinese controls, because rare earths are a little bit farther back in the supply chain, are naturally having an effect, would have an effect, depending on how they enforced it, on a much broader set of products. Mm-hmm. But again, a lot of this depends on how these things are actually implemented, monitored, implemented, and enforced. And it's really hard, for example, to enforce extraterritorial controls, right? Because, you know, you can control what your companies do within your own borders, but if you're asserting the right to tell Taiwan and a company in Taiwan what to do, that's a little more problematic, right? How do you enforce that? How do you monitor that? It's much more difficult to do. So some people think, for example, the Chinese controls right out of the gate would be really hard to implement. And they're right, because, you know, it would require companies and countries to abide by Chinese requirements. In the case of U.S., it's been easy.
That's what our approach requires, right? I mean, we have long had this.
Our approach is predicated on that most of these countries are U.S. allies, so that they will go along with this. Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, and the EU. Whereas China would be trying to do this in countries that are not allies, right?
So as a formal technical matter, our approach is legalistic, which is, in other words, we say, if you're going to, and just to give people a sense for how broad the leverage we exercise is, if you're this Dutch company that makes the most sophisticated chip manufacturing equipment in the world and is the only source of the stuff that manufactures the very highest end chips, we can say, that technology draws on some American intellectual property, right? Or something like that. As a result,
Laser.
So you have to sign this, you have to get a license, basically, or you can't export. Now, that's what China is saying. And as a strictly legal matter, it's exactly comparable. But you're saying, hey, there's no global authority that actually enforces international legal things. So it helps if they're your allies. And right. The Netherlands is our ally.
Well, the Netherlands, though, it's more complicated than that, where the Netherlands, for example, and Japan, there are allies, but they're also reluctant to completely align sure. with the U.S. controls because it disadvantages their companies, right? Their mm-hmm. companies have to forego sales to China, and the Dutch government or the Japanese government may not fully align with the right. views of the U.S. government about what the threat is or what the ultimate justification.
What they do in those cases is negotiate with us, and we have made some concessions mm-hmm. to them and weakened some things, but they don't just defy us, right?
No.
They talk us into loosening things.
No, they can't defy us because technically the U.S., the Commerce Department could impose more punitive measures, right? They could order mm-hmm. U.S. companies to stop supplying stuff, right? I mean, there are ways for the U.S. government to take more drastic action. Now, nobody wants to go there, right? The U.S. government doesn't want to be seen as, preventing companies like ASML or allied companies from being able to produce equipment, right? That would be a really bad look. Mm-hmm. So the U.S. has to use sort of persuasion to say, look, we know you're not going to go along fully with these controls, but hey, we prefer if you don't sell mm-hmm. these advanced lithography machines to China because, and so mm-hmm. then the Dutch government and Japanese government are in a difficult position. And they've been going back and forth for 3 years, really, about how much of the U.S. controls to implement. And they've, they sort of settled on, we'll do some things, we won't do others, right?
Okay. So let's get back to what Trump was reacting to, we're going to eventually get back to what that reaction was a reaction to that the right. U.S. had most recently right. done right. to China. But first, it is your view that what China had done that Trump was reacting to is not quite as important as some people are saying and not quite as important as Trump thought? Is that right? I mean, it's important, but it's not.
It's important.
Yeah.
It's important, but the critical thing is it wasn't, there was some media, I won't name the media and the reporters, who appeared to portray this as a sort of unilateral Chinese action that was designed to bring the U.S. to its knees as part of these trade talks. And that's just an mm-hmm. absurd take on this, right? Because very clearly, and I'll just give you a quick thumbnail here, the U.S., what the Chinese were reacting to was the U.S. pushing out a control on September 29th, just before the government shutdown, in the evening of the 29th, pushing out the so-called 50% rule or affiliates rule. And this mm-hmm. this is a rule that would essentially automatically apply the entity list, which is this restrictive list that restricts companies from getting access to U.S. technology, to any subsidiary of a company on the entity list if there was a 50% ownership stake. And the problem
Held by who? If who held
it? If a Chinese company okay. is on the entity list and they hold a 50% stake in a subsidiary, then that subsidiary would automatically be put on the entity list.
Well, wait, did we already say any company with a 50% Chinese stake is on the entity list or not?
No. In the Treasury world, for example, if the Treasury Department sanctions a bank, then mm-hmm. automatically any subsidiaries of those banks would be put on the entity list. And that's a much more serious,
So far, on the entity list...
There hasn't been this automatic placing of subsidiary companies on the list. Now, this is complicated because determining ownership, one, is difficult, right? Like normally, companies in the U.S. that are selling into China don't necessarily do due diligence on who owns the uh-huh. company, right? So that's one thing. So that immediately, this put a big burden on U.S. companies to figure out ownership, right? And traditionally, the export control regulations where basically the government saying, you should be worried about this company, and we're telling you this. Now the government is saying, in effect, you have to determine whether your customer is a problem, right? And that's a huge thing. So that's one level of concern.
So let me make sure I've got this. So The entities list is a list of companies that cannot buy these restricted technologies.
No, it's a list of companies that for which a license is required.
For which a license is required. We often use a licensing requirement to keep them from getting technology.
Right. We often tell them who they can tell.
Previously, it wasn't the case that any particular degree of Chinese involvement in a country was in and of itself sufficient cause to put them on that list. It was more a piecemeal thing. We say this company, but now it's any company with a 50% Chinese stake. I can see how they might get annoyed by that.
With a 50% Chinese stake of an entity listed company. Right. But immediately that would affect an estimated, we've been saying, as many as 10,000 Chinese companies. Okay. So the idea that this was that the US rule was somehow, you know, not that bad, and the Chinese then escalated is really, frankly, bunk, right? Because the impact of that rule potentially is actually more than 10,000 companies in China, right? Mm-hmm. And let me just give you one example of how complicated this immediately made the situation. So you may have been reading about this company called Nexperia, which is a Dutch company. And guess what? They make a lot of semiconductors. They're not advanced, so there's not an advanced semiconductor component to that. But they make a lot of stuff for EVs and solar panels and sort of consumer stuff, right? And they make them in China. But they're based, they have a Dutch, the company is really headquartered in the Netherlands, but they were acquired by a Chinese company called WingTech. And late last year, the Commerce Department put WingTech on the entity list. So technically then, under this new 50% rule, this Nexperia, which is based in the Netherlands, that company would then fall automatically under these export controls, right? And so what happened over the last couple of weeks was, and it's a complicated issue because the Chinese CEO of this company probably misused funds. And so what happened was the Dutch government ended up taking over the company, right? But one of the reasons they did that is because they were concerned that if the company had Chinese ownership, they would then be subject to this 50% rule, and then they would have trouble getting access to tools and technology. Now, this is a systemically important company that that supplies a lot of industries, and including the auto industry. So already, for example, today I was on the phone talking about this. You know, companies are worried that they could run out of product because in reaction to the Dutch government takeover of this company, the Chinese have restricted exports of this company's products from China, where about 60 or 70% of their products are coming. So this is an example where some of the critics of this have said, well, China's controls are global and the US controls are more narrow. Well, no, this is an example where the 50% rule, which China was reacting to here in implementing the rare earth controls, already has had a big impact on this company in the Netherlands because they are now technically subject to the to this 50% rule. And some of the very complicated restructuring and ownership issues around that were because the Dutch government was anticipating the company coming under this control and then not being able to buy equipment, which would be a huge thing, right? So anyway, so the implications of this 50% control are not just narrow and they're global, and also they're, if we talk about 10,000 companies from a Chinese point of view, this is a big deal. And then finally, again, the bigger context, which we have to get to, is we're in the middle of this very delicate trade negotiations between the U.S. and China. And what came out of meetings in Geneva earlier this year and Madrid in August was a tacit agreement on both sides not to do this kind of thing, right? Now, it wasn't written down, and neither side, that we've gotten different, but both sides will interpret that differently. But we understand from talking to a lot of people that there was this tacit agreement specifically not to do this kind of escalation while this delicate trade negotiation was going on. So China, in reacting to this, and again, China over the last 2 years has pretty much reacted to everything the U.S. has done in this arena. Any kind of new controls, any kind of companies added to the entity list, China has chosen to respond in many different ways. One of the ways they've responded is on the rare earth side. So when this rule was pushed out on September 29th, I immediately knew that China was going to react badly to this, right? And so we mm-hmm. warned clients of this well before this really hit the media. And then, of course, on October 9th, which was 7 days after the Chinese holiday, because the rule was pushed out in the U.S. just before the government shutdown, but also just before the Chinese national holiday on October 1st. Mm-hmm. Sure enough, on October 9th, the Chinese released these rules on rare earths, right? And then Trump did the Truth Social post that you mentioned. So
which his retaliation of his hasn't transpired yet, but there's still a sense that the U.S. mm-hmm. may well do something, possibly more in this same realm of tech. Who knows? But think, yeah. Now, before we get to that, I just want to sort of review. So it sounds like, first of all, this is like, you know, a classic case where we're looking at things from our point of view and they from theirs, naturally. So this 50% thing, you know, makes waves in China, but I don't remember seeing what's that. I don't remember seeing that much about it in U.S. newspapers, whereas the Chinese retaliation, which you said is not surprising, that like comes, you know, in the American right. media, it's like this thing came out of the blue. Like, what's going on? They're going to cut right. off our rare yeah. earth minerals.
Well, unfortunately, there were some early reporting on this from places like the Wall Street Journal, shall we say. And, you know, the characterization of this, in my view, was
is that
really,
the name you said you weren't going to name, Paul? Is that
I
the name
said
you
the
said?
Wall Street Journal. I didn't name any names.
I know, but, you know, we do have an overtime session that's for paying.
I don't want to name any names, but let's just say the media.
Okay, then I will name just, names in the overtime section. But
it was media outlets, and then it was reinforced by other sort of commentators in the China tech space, right? Who, again, in my view, grossly mischaracterized what China was doing. So one characterization of this was that this was a unilateral effort by China to bring uh-huh. the U.S. to its knees as part of this uh-huh. trade negotiation, which in my view was like a completely tendentious sort of assessment of this, right? Because this was clearly, and now slowly the media is coming around to this, it was clearly a response to the 50% rule, right? And again, I noted this right away on September 29th. So if I could figure it out, you know, others should have been able to figure it out. But, you know, if you're looking for China to be, you know, if you're looking for aggression or coercion from China, then you will find it. It's like, wasn't it Stalin who said, you know, show me the crime and I'll show you, show me the man and I'll show you the crime, right? So, you know, here, I've heard that a couple times in the last few days. So I'm not sure if it's quite applicable here, but I think it is. So, you know, there, if you're looking for signs that China is being aggressive or you know, retaliating, then you look at this a different way. If you looked at the whole picture, and again, we have to go back before the Madrid talks to understand what prompted initially the Chinese use of rare earths, which is really critical to understand, right? Because the rare earth issue didn't come out of nowhere either, right? The rare earth issue has been percolating, if you will, arguably since October of 2022, when the U.S. Yeah. first started imposing these very sweeping controls.
China did a little shot across the bow on that during the Obama administration, I remember. Because I remember thinking Obama should make hay out of this politically. He should go on TV and say, I mean, I'm just thinking as a politician. He should go on TV and say, okay, we're going to, you know, this is, you can see this is a challenge, and we're going to develop agreements with various countries that in the future will blah, blah, blah.
To Japan, in the case of, in 2010, the Japanese, there was a dispute around the Diaoyu Islands, which are disputed islands off the coast of Japan. And mm-hmm. in response to Japanese actions, the Chinese government restricted temporarily exports of rare earths to Japan. And that was the first sort of time that China had, you know, chosen this thing. But this was in a very different time.
Yeah.
When,
okay.
For example,
yeah, sure.
The demand for rare earths was very low, that we didn't have EVs.
Yeah.
And
I shouldn't have distracted us with that.
Yeah. That's an important context too, because in response to that, you're exactly right. Japan, the Japanese government responded by trying to beef up its production of rare earths and try to reduce dependence on China. And they've made some progress in the last 15 years. The U.S., though, for complicated reasons, did not do anything about rare earths. And so, you know, very little, not nothing, but not a whole lot. And so when people woke up on the morning of April 4th, when China put in place this global licensing regime around rare earths, many, many people in the U.S. were caught off guard because U.S. companies hadn't stockpiled rare earth materials or magnets. And there was no serious industrial policy or government effort to assist the private sector to compete with, by now, very powerful Chinese companies. Right.
This is April 4th of what year?
April 4th of this year was when China imposed a global ban on the shipments of rare earths and magnets from China and put in place a licensing regime around those sectors. That's a decisive inflection point in this whole thing, right? Because that was basically China saying, we will use this choke point, these choke point technologies and materials that we have, and we will control them for military end use. And you're going to have to deal with this.
And that was a reaction, presumably largely to our chip controls.
That was the culmination of a 3-year process kicked off by, I believe, maybe even a little earlier by U.S. controls on Huawei, but primarily kicked off by U.S. controls on sweeping controls in October of 2022 on GPUs and semiconductor manufacturing tools. So China, since that time, in the 2 years or 2.5 years before April 4th, put in place lists and things and a lot of other laws, but none of them had any real teeth, right, to produce pain in the U.S., right? Yeah. None of them. So, they inconvenienced companies, and they were some with other impacts. Yeah. But until they sort of landed on the critical minerals piece, and this was previewed last year by controls on gallium, germanium, and graphite, which are not rare earths, but they're critical minerals. That was sort of the test case. They kicked the tires on a licensing regime, and they learned a lot about supply chains. And then eventually, they extended this to these 7 rare earths that they started controlling on April 4th. And that was a huge wake-up call, for the U.S.
So some of the roots of this lie in the Biden administration. I mean, Trump won, the first Trump administration, he had kind of tightened the screws a little, but the Biden administration really ramped up the chip controls. And a question I have is, when you look at this from China's point of view, I mean, the U.S. has, for a few years, been saying a couple of things, basically. One of them, sometimes implicit, sometimes explicit, and this is also said by people in the AI business, is we think the country that has the dominant AI is going to dominate the world. I mean, that's the premise. And so we're going to maintain dominance, and we're going to deny China the means to compete with us effectively in AI. We say these things. Didn't somebody say, if they really buy our premise that this technology is so critical and we do this, we should expect some kind of super major retaliation at some point. I mean, do you know whether the people in the Biden administration gamed this out?
No, they didn't. Not at all. So that's the problem. That's the sort of, as we say in Chinese, gunbun de wen ti, the sort of fundamental problem is. So it's even worse than that. So the architects of those controls did not do, first of all, they didn't do a cost-benefit analysis. Normally at the Commerce Department, for example, when they were doing controls on space technology, there's a requirement on the books to do a cost-benefit analysis. Like, if you're going to impose these controls, what's the impact on U.S. business? What's the impact on global markets? The architects of these controls in the Biden era were sort of proud almost that they didn't do any kind of cost-benefit analysis.
Is this like Jake Sullivan?
US
are there some names you will name? Can we name Jake Sullivan?
Well, he was the national security advisor. Yeah. So he was the sort of he was the
But also this guy, who's the other guy? Campbell? What's his name? What's his name? That China Kirk guy Campbell, in the Biden.
Yeah. No, look, okay. the architects of this were a small group of people who came out of, some think tanks in D.C. who had this idea about choke point technologies, right? Mm-hmm. And there were a couple of threads to this. One of them was this idea that, first of all, that you mentioned AI. So there was this sort of nascent idea about that called compute governance. And the idea there was, as AI gets more and more capable and you have more and more compute that you need to develop these AI models and capabilities, if you can control the compute, then you can control the pace of development of AI. And that's a much older idea that came out of the the late, 2010s. People like Nick Bostrom talked about this because, there was worry at some point that malicious actors could get a hold of advanced, compute, and they could do bad things with AI. Just like we worried about malicious actors getting a hold of nuclear materials and, building nuclear weapons, right? So this idea came out. But then it wasn't really until 2020, 2021, until the Biden administration that people who both believed that, that AI was going to be a big deal and that China was going to be a good advanced developer of things like AI, and that three, the U.S. retained the ability to control those choke point technologies before that sort of group came into power or came into policymaking, that they could operationalize ideas like using export controls, because that was the tool that was around, right? People, there aren't that many tools that the U.S. government can deploy here, but export controls, again, which were not designed to do this. Export controls were not designed to maintain U.S. technology hegemony or to slow down China. They were designed to control the spread of weapons of mass destruction, right?
Right.
Which is a much more narrow thing, and you can do this in ways that don't disrupt broader supply chains. But when the U.S. applied export controls for the first time to the big multinationals like Huawei and ZTE in 2019 and 2020, that was a big deal because those companies had complicated global supply chains, which drew in, oh, by the way, many U.S. companies and many foreign companies too, right? Because those supply chains did not originate in the U.S. And the other thing is, same with semiconductors. All semiconductor supply chains don't originate in the U.S., even if the U.S. companies control some of those choke point technologies. So the problem is that the designers of these controls didn't take into account the global impact on supply chains and the fact that these weren't technologies that U.S. companies alone controlled. It was a much more global enterprise, right? Taiwan, South Korea, Japan, the Netherlands, Israel, lots of companies, Germany, a lot of companies in the supply chain. And so not only was there no cost benefit analysis, there was no real assessment of two other critical things. One was the impact on global players, and the third one was, what is the Chinese retaliation going to be for this? As you adroitly point out, that's probably the most important thing that wasn't considered, because now, so if you want to trace this forward, closing of an Explorer factory in Detroit because of rare earths can be traced back directly to October of 2022, right? Now, very few people will make that connection because you have to understand, the whole sweep of the last 3 to 5 years and what China is reacting to, right? Which is this constant drumbeat starting in arguably 2019, 2020, but accelerating in October of 2022 of more controls, more companies on the entity list, more controls, more companies on the entity list, a sort of during the Biden administration, almost never ending thing. And then finally, just the last point, in November of 2024, President Xi Jinping met with former President Biden, on the margins of APEC in Jakarta. And I think it was Jakarta. And he said, he put at that meeting, because President Xi by this time was very exercised about these export controls. And he told President Biden that was a red line. So a red line, there's a red line on Taiwan, right? Taiwan, if the U.S. supports Taiwan independence, that's a red line for China. But he put export controls on par with Taiwan as a red line for China. And then after that, the election, the Biden administration pushed out at least 5 major new controls, export control packages, after President Biden had been warned by President Xi. So at that point, my sense is the Chinese determined that they were going to really go and push the rare earth thing as a really, strong tit for tat that they realized by that point would have a big impact. Because they had been, as I noted, they had been working with gallium and germanium and graphite, which had produced a lot of concern in Japan and in the U.S. because of how critical those minerals are to semiconductors and autos. Okay. So they, by late in the Biden administration, the Chinese government realized that they needed something stronger to push back on than, putting companies on lists.
And they
that
found it.
Really
so
had any
so
effect.
Let me, so obviously, like, not, when you're in any kind of potentially tit for tat situation, and you're going to, either do tariffs or export controls, and you don't do the thought of experiment of how the other country might react. that is a recipe for things getting out of control.
It's a recipe for disaster, frankly.
And let me just say, so you mentioned like media outlets. I think you used the word podcast and how they've reacted to this. I was listening to a podcast whose name, as it happens, rhymes with China Hawk. And they had I think you know which one I mean. They had two guys on named Chris, one of whom was from the Biden administration. I think it was Miller and McGuire. And
Chris McGuire.
And yeah. I don't know, did you listen to this? But the premise, it's like it seemed to go without saying that the U.S. now had to respond to this by, you know, with something that China might.
Right.
Yeah. Now, I will say at least one of them said, ideally, you find something, I think, you know, that allows us to go into further talks with China. I think there's an expectation that Trump and Xi may be talking soon. That allows us to go into this in a strong position, but doesn't provoke another reaction. Okay, so I just want to acknowledge they at least had the wisdom to say, ideally, our next escalation would not lead to escalation. I don't know how realistic that is, but
Let's pull in one more data point that's relevant to that. So this escalation on the U.S. side was not the first escalation. So after the rare...
Wait, do you mean the 50% rule?
Yeah, there was a second escalation, right? So it's important to note that. So
and that was... Let me just wait. And that was not some kind of response to something China had done? Our 50% escalation was just, and this too. It wasn't... That was not a retaliation.
No, the 50% escalation was not in response to something China had done. It was just pushed. Okay. So, but what happened the timeline here is important. So April 4th, China rolls out rare earth controls. The U.S. kind of freaks out and meet the trade teams meet in Geneva, right? And so during that meeting, the effort was to try to get China to, you know, to license, basically to put it, to expedite licensing of rare earths, because it was starting to be clear that this would have a big impact. So the two sides met in Geneva, and then the Chinese agreed to expedite licenses for rare earths for the auto industry, for example. But then days after the Geneva talks, in a similar, eerily similar situation, the Commerce Department rolled out guidance that said, anywhere in the world that companies are using the Ascend, the Huawei Ascend processor, they could be violating U.S. export controls and be subject to punitive.
Yeah, we should say the Huawei Ascend is part of China's attempt to develop an indigenous capability to produce the highest end chips. The Ascend isn't like up there with the NVIDIA Blackwell, it's moving in that direction, and now we're trying to get in the way of that.
The argument was, technically, that Ascend processor is being produced in China. Some of it was produced in Taiwan, but that's a whole other story. But it's produced in China using U.S. equipment, and we don't really know exactly how much. But the U.S. again was asserting this extraterritorial export control and saying, okay, SMIC, which is the Chinese leading domestic foundry, likely made these, although, you know, everything is very fuzzy because now companies don't want to say if they're manufacturing things on behalf of Huawei because of the U.S. controls. The U.S. was asserting this again, that Huawei, if you buy Huawei equipment, if you buy those chips somewhere else and use them, you could run afoul of export controls, which was sort of an escalation, because before it was you can't supply them. But they were saying if you're using them anywhere, you could run afoul of U.S. export controls. But it wasn't a rule. It was just sort of like weird guidance. But the Chinese went ballistic on this, okay? So the Chinese trade negotiator that same week wanted to get on the phone with the USTR, which was part of the U.S. trade negotiating team, because they were livid. I talked to a lot of people about this, right? So the Chinese viewed this as a breach of the, again, sort of tacit agreement that we're having these sensitive talks, we're trying to work out issues around tariffs and export controls, and here you're going and adding more fuel to the fire, right? So that led, if you remember, that led the U.S. to escalate. So the response to that is important to understand, because it could come into play now. The U.S. response, urged by certain people in the administration, was, let's escalate and show the Chinese we mean business, escalate to de-escalate. In other words, we'll threaten to do more export controls
if you don't back down.
So the U.S. put in place controls on aircraft spare parts. China has a lot of Boeing aircraft, right? They need spare parts. They put controls on ethane gas. They put controls on EDA tools, either semiconductor design tools. And they put controls on other really key technologies, actually, that China uses in some of the semiconductor supply chain stuff they're doing in China. So this was a big deal. That led eventually to the phone call between Presidents Biden Presidents Trump and Xi to sort of step back from this, because the result of the U.S. controls was that China slowed down the approval of these licenses, and then U.S. companies, auto companies, for example, were running out of magnets, right? So the two leaders got on the phone and they said, look, we now know that we can shut down factories in each other's countries, right? So why don't we step back from this? So that led to then a truce and to further talks and further discussion. In the meantime, the Chinese Ministry of Commerce approved many licenses. We have many clients. Most of our clients have gotten most of their licenses to import rare earths and magnets since then, right? So then fast forward to September, and you know, more discussions. Everybody is working towards a summit of some sort in South Korea, a meeting between the two leaders. And then the U.S. pushes out this 50% rule, right? So from the Chinese point of view, this was another violation of the spirit of Geneva and Madrid, because again, in Madrid, that there had been another reiteration of this tacit agreement to not do these kinds of things. So from the Chinese point of view, this was not the first time, but the second time the U.S. had violated the tacit agreement, right? So therefore, when they rolled out these controls, my view is they went a little bit, you know, they could have just rolled out a few of them, but they went a little bit, they wanted to almost escalate this to show, hey, look, you know, we're serious, right? I mean, if you're going to if you're going to continue to put, say, 10,000 Chinese companies on the entity list through this new rule, we're going to up the ante. We're going to say, look, we want to even more control over our rare earth exports, and we're going to up the ante here. So it was both a response and a slight escalation, because I think my sense is the Chinese were very frustrated that, you know, after months of meetings here, right, we're talking about, you know, four meetings in different capitals in Europe and a lot of back and forth, the U.S. side was still in the view of Beijing, you know, violating these agreements at a very sensitive time when they were trying to keep the truce on. And, you know, again, the tariffs are all still in place. Most of the tariffs, there's been a tariff moratorium that was also in place that runs out in November. But, you know, these were sensitive discussions, right? And the U.S. side, again, in the Chinese view, violated the sort of tacit agreement not to escalate. And so that's why I'm sort of shocked in some sense even more that the reaction from some of the media and commentators was this was the Chinese are escalating, right? I mean, you know, it came within a very specific context, right?
It's a classic cognitive empathy problem. As I said, you know, we all naturally tend to view things from our own point of view. As I said, we go into overtime at some point. We're about to do it. This is for available paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. You can become one by going to the Non-Zero newsletter. You'll find, first of all, the post representing this, and you can go right there and listen to overtime or watch it. Or you can set up your podcast feed so that forevermore, you'll have easy and automatic access. In overtime, we're going to discuss, okay, so where do we go from here? What's likely to happen? What does Paul think should happen? And before we do that, we're going to remind people that Paul puts out the Substack analytical product, AI Stack Decrypted. Not a newsletter, although Substack is a newsletter platform. There's one exception to the otherwise reliable rule that everything on this platform is a newsletter. And that would be Paul's analytical product, which is called AI Stack Decrypted. It's getting a growing amount of attention and we hope wielding a growing amount of influence in the highest councils of government. Okay, thanks everybody for coming with us this far. Now we go into overtime.